sunshine was a mole in the ground. I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO, Portland. The old mole is the beast that works underground to expose and undermine the foundations of a society that gives to the rich and takes from the poor, claiming all the while to be based on just and democratic principles. The philosopher Theodore Adorno remarked once that in the house of the hangman you should not speak of the rope, otherwise you will open yourself to the suspicion that you are a rancorous person. Well, in the House of Capital, one is not supposed to speak of wage slavery and the dictatorial power of the super rich, but that is just what we do on the Old Mole while trying not to appear rancorous in the homes of you, our listeners. I'm Clayton Morgridge, along with our engineer, Patricia Kullberg, bringing you an hour of news and commentary you won't often hear elsewhere. On today's show, we'll be hearing about a film, Killer of Sheep, about life and work among African Americans in Watts in the 1970s. I'll have a commentary about the way life in capitalist society cripples our inner lives, particularly the erotic side of life. And we'll hear from Thomas Hanna of the Democracy Collaborative about his work on public democratic ownership of some parts of the economy. And in just a moment, Bill Resnick will be talking with Amy Cantrell, who works to bring people together for mutual aid in times of disaster, like the recent storm in North Carolina, Hurricane Florence. First, though, let me remind you that you can access any part of this show you'd like to hear again by going to the KBOO website, kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour, or to wherever you get your podcasts, and you can subscribe to this show. And now, here's Bill Resnick with Amy Cantrell.
Amy Cantrell, welcome to KBOO.
I am so honored to be sounding with you across the country, and I'm excited to be connected to KBOO and all the good folks in Portland and beyond.
I first encountered Amy Cantrell listening to an interview of her on Asheville FM, a radio station, much like KBOO in Asheville, North Carolina. Asheville itself is pretty high up in the western mountains of North Carolina. It got very wet, but was largely spared the terrible winds and flooding of Hurricane Florence. On the interview, Amy discussed how the people and organizations of Asheville and her in an important role came together to assist the poor people of Lumberton and Robeson County. It's very poor, people of color, mostly black. It's near the Atlantic coast and terribly flooded and damaged. Amy Cantrell, you're an ordained reverend. How did you happen to have an important role in organizing for justice in Asheville and especially in the midst of Florence, but before that, too?
I see myself as really a minister of the people and a minister that spends most of my time in the street, and particularly with people that have been shoved to the margins and oppressed, and who I think see very clearly how our systems have aligned against the common people in a very intersectional way, and so that we must organize across all these different intersections, particularly of race and class, gender, and all the ways that I think the people have had their backs pushed against the wall and had the boots, so to speak, of the system on their neck, that we must organize together collectively to become human again and to humanize our institutions and our communities and to really begin building from the ground up systems that really function for the people. All of the things that we know that really began to cause us to thrive as communities. And so I came to that work by founding Beloved Asheville, which is an intentional community to do just that and recognize the power of the people in creating their own solutions. They know what the struggles are and are able to create some of the most innovative solutions to those struggles.
Amy, what in your background led you to this form of ministry?
A wonderful question that I love to tell. As a very young student, I grew up in a fundamentalist household in a little town called Spartanburg, South Carolina. And really, so much of the South, even after the Civil Rights Movement, was sort of de facto segregated. And, you know, one of the things that happened to me is that I went on a week-long excursion to New York City. And part of that work was to begin to see those that had been pushed to the margins and who were oppressed. And I met a man sitting on the steps of a locked church, a very cathedral-like, huge painted red door. And his street name was Catman, and he was a poet. And I remember him just speaking so powerfully and eloquently about life and our connection that we had. And that was the moment of being radicalized. If you sort of know your scriptures, one of the powerful words in scripture says that Jesus will come to us in the guise of those who are hungry, who are strangers, who are locked up in prison, who are sick. So I really began to say, here's this man that, according to scripture, is deity, being locked out of the church. That was a very powerful moment. I went on that week to meet Cornel West and Bell Hooks. So I came back south from that one-week trip. I went to school in my hometown, to college, and so I said, there are people here just like there. And I began to seek them out and began to sit at soup kitchen tables with them and hang out on the streets with them. And that really radicalized me in a very powerful way. And I began to learn about all these wonderful streams within my own faith. And I think there's streams within every faith tradition, that stream of saying that really is political, that faith is political and life is political, is how we organize ourselves and community together. And beginning to form a community that really allows us to see each other, where folks that have been pushed away and labeled as deficits are brought into the full life of the community and seen as gifts. That as we create community, we transform each other in our institutions.
Amy, tell us about the work of so many people in Asheville. Tell us about how Asheville organized to work with coastal people, most of them the poor in Robeson County.
Well, this is an interesting story because it really starts on the ground of Asheville, and it starts a year before. We have a group that we bring together through Beloved Asheville called Homeless Voice, and it is a group of people who are homeless and formerly homeless that raise their voices in public policy decisions that directly impact their community, and also to say we are the people we've been waiting for. And so in the midst last year of Homeless Voice, we had another storm bearing down on us that would make landfall in North Carolina and surely come to Asheville. And our folks said, what's being done to make sure that we're safe? We called city entities and we were trying to find out the answer, and no one would return our calls. And so we opened a storm shelter because we know often institutions like the Red Cross or local governments, the threshold for storm shelters and things like that, infrastructure to be sort of ramped up in these situations, is when housed people are endangered. And we know people that are homeless, folks here sleep, you know, right next to rivers. They sort of squat on land. It's illegal to be homeless anywhere in Asheville after about 10 o'clock at night. And so we knew that they were in really grave danger of trees falling on them, of rivers swelling very quickly and sweeping them away. And so as Florence came on the radar, we began preparing, and we said, we've got to ramp up again. And so we at BLove had the first homeless street medic team in the country. So we organized them to go out and to begin letting folks know, all unsheltered people know, that the storm was coming. And we were able to get the city government and other shelters to a meeting where we discussed and we opened up extra shelters. And so BLove opened a shelter for special populations, folks that don't fit in the shelter system. We reached out to our partners at Appalachian Medical Solidarity, who are folks that are medics in lots of different situations, whether protests or disasters. So we began to work together on the storm shelter and the like, and then also creating a connection out east, because it became very clear quickly that the brunt of the storm was going to hit east of us. And so we began to work together to mobilize supplies. It was a team that went as soon as they could move that Saturday. They drove as far as they could drive to see what they could do. And often that's what happens, is we sort of just go into these situations not knowing what we're going to be doing or where we're going to be. And they were able to get as far as Raleigh-Durham, and every road was underwater. They met some disaster pilots who began to fly folks in to affected areas. And so at Bela, we started organizing big supply collection and then drivers that would drive to Raleigh-Durham. And then we would have folks hop on the planes with these disaster pilots and be flown in to areas. And so our first crew got flown into Lumberton, and we met some folks there on the ground and began working with them and just realized, like, this was sort of the worst scenarios. There's mandatory orders to evacuate, and the folks that get left behind are people that are too poor to evacuate. They don't have vehicles. They don't have money to be able to travel. We were actually literally on the radio at V-Love to friends that were in Wilmington that were in the same scenario. They were afraid that they didn't have enough gas to evacuate, and they thought that they would get stuck somewhere, so they just stayed. So all of this was happening at the same time. It was a really powerful experience of just people coming together to say, these are our neighbors. They are the worst hit. In these rural areas that are very poor, mostly people of color, they weren't seeing very quick response at all from government institutions. In fact, government institutions were diverting things to Wilmington. So there was a struggle with some of our folks on the ground who were trying to defend supplies that were we were trying to send to rural areas that government entities were trying to divert to the bigger cities.
This
is interesting ground to be on as all this develops.
That's the story that Rebecca Solnit, we'll get to her a little later, tells, that during Katrina and Sandy and many other, even the earthquake, San Francisco in 1906, and also, to a lesser extent, the earthquake of 1989 in San Francisco, but it was people helping people that the state operated, often, in fact, to save poor people because they were afraid of looting and murder, none of which ever happened in Katrina. All the murder was done by the police of people trying to cross the bridge, as it turned out. In fact, nobody even contests that. And some of the police were scapegoated and put in jail, but that was the orders. They just caged the poor blacks mostly to make sure that they wouldn't loot and murder, which, of course, they weren't doing at all. But that's the sort of the fantasy of the people who run things.
That's how white supremacy functions.
Yes, that's
exactly that. Is that operating under stereotypes, fearing people living in black bodies, fearing looting and violence, when in fact those folks are the actual victims because they have been oppressed for centuries at this point, and not having, you know, if we look at equity in terms of the wealth gap, we know these are going to be the folks that are left behind in these storms. And then being left behind, they're then caged, which we see happening to black bodies institutionally from the time of slavery developing into Jim Crow and then into the new Jim Crow of mass incarceration. So these, you know, I think disasters really point up the things that we see all the time, that are there all the time, but they're sort of writ large during these disasters. We'll see these institutions and isms functioning in such a macro visible way. And in fact, Dr. Barber and I say this during the original interview on Ashby FM, talked about, you know, that these storms are a window to the real chronic ongoing storms of poverty and injustice and environmental degradation that we see. So these are a window, I think, to the isms that are always operating in America.
This is Cable Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole, talking to Amy Cantrell, who works in Asheville, set up an organization, Beloved Community. She's an ordained minister. She wears her habit, she told me, her whole costume, only when she's going to court to help poor people defend themselves or in mass demonstrations when the authorities are about to commit violence. It's much harder for them to do when you have some people in the clerical outfits. Amy, let's get back to Rebecca Solnit. She also, in her book, A Paradise Built in Hell, she talks about what's also characteristic about disasters is how ordinary people respond, which is to help one another. They respond in dignity and decency and humanity, often risking their lives as they did in both Sandy and Katrina very recently to save just strangers. And Solnit argues that this is like a high point for many of the people. What they're doing, this is expression of humanity, is for them, it's this relief from the individualism and defensiveness that they have to display in getting by in this country and world. You know, you have to protect yourself, or you can be one of the people camping near the river, or not having medical care, or all the other cudgels over our head. Those first responders find that they're now expressing their humanity. And for Solnit, in her book, she makes this very convincing case that in fact, is basic human nature, is caring for one another and being satisfied in group efforts. Your organization and the people in them and the medics and all the people you work with, do you get that sense? It's an opportunity to really show your real self, not the self that you sort of have to display in ordinary life.
I think that's a beautiful and powerful description of what is real. And we find that these storms, as horrific as they are also an invitation to deep compassion and being able to mobilize in very beautiful and radical ways to help one another. And as you say, even folks willing to sacrifice their lives for each other. I think that we have been lured into the lies the system tells us for that system to function, to benefit a very few people. And what you reflect from the book are exactly that, these lies of individualism and that I've got to protect mine, I've got to get mine. So I think what happens, you know, oftentimes in these storms is we are taken out of our norm and out of these systems in some ways. And where I'm reminded of a man named William Stringfellow, who was a street lawyer in Harlem. And one of the things that he wrote was that our vocation is to really be human. And so I think we long for ways to express our true humanity.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Amy Cantrell, an organizer, founder of Beloved Asheville, a leader in the community effort to aid the poor in coastal North Carolina. And we've been talking about how Asheville organized, as well as the truly inhuman response by authorities. We've been talking about that. We've been also talking about the impulse to help and build community that occurs in disasters where people discover their humanity. Amy, one last issue. Conservatives, they sort of love these local and charitable efforts. They say, isn't it wonderful that people come to the aid of the poor and troubled and love to do it? In fact, they argue that considering all this volunteering and compassion and charity, that there's really nothing to be done by the state. The state should sort of run things and make sure there's law and order. But in fact, when it comes down to helping the poor, well, it's the state just gets in the way, that the churches should do it and all of those good people should do it. There's no need for programs for the poor, and certainly no need to somehow change the system. That's one of their arguments, actually, of conservatives, that the answer to poverty is compassion and charity. What's wrong with that argument?
I think there's a lot wrong with that argument, and I think that we can really point out, first of all, that we don't see ourselves as a charity. We see ourselves as a community of mutuality, mutual aid and liberation. And in fact, a lot of the folks that were working on the ground here preparing other folks for the storm were homeless street medics. And I think that's a really good example of folks who train every week with registered nurses and EMTs to do the work of love on the ground. I think where conservatives get it right is to say government can be problematic. And I think that is the fallen nature of the state at this particular time. Truly, politics and government are and should be, in their purest definition, people gathered together and organizing something bigger than themselves in order to do the work that individuals or smaller communities can't do. And so if you look at that definition, you know, I think that government is wholly failing us for all the ways that it's not doing that. And I think certainly here in North Carolina, and you could argue nationally, that conservatives actually exacerbate that situation, exacerbate the need for quote-unquote charity that they so love, through what Dr. Barber with the National Poor People's Campaign calls these chronic storms of injustice, of racism, of poverty. of environmental degradation. And in fact, we can point to it in this particular case as we saw $10 million move from the FEMA budget right before hurricane season into the budget for Immigration, Customs and Enforcement, the ICE budget, because there was more need to detain and deport people, and particularly, as we know, detain families and children. To talk about conservatives who say government just gets in the way, actually government is being violent and is on the offense, if you will, in these particular situations, and we see it time and time again. We saw ICE in the storm during Florence actually looking for people in storm shelters. These are reports that we got directly from folks on the ground. We've lived through the disasters. We had the disaster of ICE raids coming to our community and taking people and separating families, and that was another time that we, as Beloved Asheville community, really came together and brought hundreds of people together because we began hearing that families weren't leaving their homes and they were hungry and they had no food for their babies and no diapers. And we were able to mobilize the community to work together and get food and Know Your Rights information and diapers and formula out to about 1,000 people in our community. But again, I don't see that as charity. I see us as really functioning as a human community in wholeness. And across these intersections that are created by systemic lies that prop up systems that benefit very few people and make them very wealthy, very oppressive systems.
Amy Cantrell, thanks so much for talking to us. It was really great.
I'm so very honored to be on KBOO Radio and to be talking with you, Bill. And again, I'm Amy Cantrell, and I'm with Beloved Asheville. Folks can reach out to us at belovedasheville.com. We'd welcome more conversations about mutual aid communities and the ways that we can mobilize together to be more human.
And thanks to Bill Resnick and Amy Cantrell for that insight into the struggle of people who have been pushed to the margins to organize to become human again. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Next, we will turn to a film about life on the margins in another time and place, Los Angeles, in the early 70s. KBOO sponsored a showing of Killer of Sheep last week, and it is now available on DVD at Movie Madness and the Multnomah County Library. It was reviewed in 2008 by our movie moles, Denise Morris and Fran Michelle, and we think it deserves another play in an edited version of that interview for you now.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here with Denise Morris to discuss Charles Burnett's 1977 film Killer of Sheep. Made as Burnett's master's thesis for UCLA Film School, Killer of Sheep was not released commercially because he couldn't afford to pay for the music rights to the soundtrack, which he designed as a history of African-American music and which includes blues, funk, classical, and ragtime. Restored and finally released on DVD for its 30th anniversary, the film has been widely praised. The main character is Stan, played by Henry Saunders, a slaughterhouse worker and a family man in Watts, Los Angeles, with two young children, a crumbling house he keeps trying to repair, and a wife he's too depressed to have sex with. We see a series of vignettes as friends and neighbors try to convince Stan to go in on a crime with them and get a dressing down from his wife about their misguided notions of masculinity. Stan and a friend buy a used engine to try to fix up a car, but the engine block cracks before they even get it home. Family and friends plan an outing to the racetrack, but the car gets a flat on the way and there's no spare. Interspersed with these vignettes are non-narrative scenes of Stan working at the slaughterhouse and kids playing in the empty lots of the neighborhood. Although it's an older film, was called one of the best films of 2007, and I think it's really still quite timely. Just yesterday, Barack Obama was making comments in honor of Father's Day about the importance of African-American men needing to take responsibility for being good fathers and the importance of individual responsibility. But I think this film really emphasizes that the question isn't so much individual responsibility as the larger context that people find themselves in and the possibilities that does and doesn't offer.
Yeah, the film is recognized as being one of the most important and leading least known American films, and that includes the director Burnett, who is considered to be one of the greatest lesser known or least known directors. And back in the period of time which he was studying at UCLA, there was a group of folks who were looking at film and looking at Hollywood and looking at the representations of particularly African Americans, but not exclusively, and trying to figure out a way to kind of refocus and reinvent identities through film, and looking a lot at anti-colonial work, but also the film work that was being done. So there was Italian neorealism that had come into play post-World War II, dating even further back, the work of British documentarian Grierson, who was doing these kind of real-life documentaries about working-class people. And then through the early part of the 60s, where Robert Drew was working with the direct cinema and the sound sync and all of these new technologies coming into play, it allowed this group of folks who were studying at UCLA to really cook up some great ideas about how to reinvent the images of minorities and African Americans in film. And importantly, the film, although it's dated 1977, was actually filmed in 72 and 73, which is less than a decade following the rebellions in Watts in 1965. And the history of Watts is also very interesting. We wouldn't get that from the film necessarily, but folks could do lots of research. That's what we did. And this film is very much in the context of the Watts community and the kind of aftermath of the rebellions and the neglect and the continuing lack of opportunity.
Yeah, which is even exacerbated, is even made worse by actually some of the success of the civil rights movement, insofar as black neighborhoods start to lose their middle class and lose what shaky economic base had developed there. And so it's left to the working class and the poor. And it's like Italian neorealism in being a sort of post-war landscape. The kids are always playing in these abandoned, in empty lots and abandoned buildings that look like they've been bombed out. So, I mean, you really get a sense of the whole neighborhood. And I think that also, that orientation comes through in the way that the film is not strongly narrative-driven and not strongly focused on Stan. I mean, he's the main character, clearly. But the very first scene in the film has characters who I don't think appear again later. I mean, so it doesn't start with Stan. It starts with this other family, and some critics have seen that as this is a flashback to Stan's childhood, or maybe it's just another family in the Watts neighborhood. It's not really clear. But there's a sense of this broader community, and Stan is our entry point or one of our entry points to that. But it's not just about his experience. It's about the way his experience is rooted in that whole community and the whole despairing political atmosphere of the time.
The thing that's, I think, important about the film and what is so amazing about it is that it was groundbreaking in its being made. And also, it really is able to work with some very important issues and ideas. I mean, it's political and it is non-narrative, but it communicates quite a lot. And I think sometimes, you know, we can get a little fuzzy with some films. People like plots. So it doesn't have that, but it is very capable of communicating. And it's structured in such a way, creatively and intellectually, to do that. It also is very much going up against the current of the time, which were the blaxploitation films, which were elevating an individual and elevating masculinity as a reaction to all sorts of social forces, of course, that said to be emasculating.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Also individualizing. And so that what this film does, and going off of what you were saying about Stan, is that he while we follow him to a degree, he is always a part of the landscape. He's always a part of the community. And that is what is so important to understand about the film, is that it goes against the current of the Hollywood film, in that there is not one person who can make something happen or change. And in fact, we don't see much change. It's not about that, you know, but that there's a larger community and forces at play that move people one way or another.
And we see that sort of repeated current of things not happening. there's one moment when a bunch of people are getting into a car and they're all sitting there packed in, and you're sort of looking through the windshield and you think they're about to go somewhere, and then one of the guys in the car reaches through. It turns out there's no windshield. He reaches through and picks up a can of beer that's sitting on the hood. You know, that everybody's sort of ready to go, but there's no place to go.
That, and no way really to get there.
No way to get there because the engine breaks and the tire turns flat.
And the car culture of L.A. is, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that the film does, another way that it fits in with larger trends in African-American culture and discourse is this idea of back home and the connections with having come from the South. Charles Burnett himself grew up in Watts but had been born in the South, and his family had moved to California when he was a child. And that World War II era migration is really the background to this, and the way that there are moments when the music, which is great in this film, is really wonderful, and or references to folklore, and become these moments of possible redemption or solace, or that it's still a source of strength when it can be accessed. And yet there's also this push to don't act like you're from the South, and chastising the kids for using phrases that make them sound like they're from the South.
There's also great imagery of some of the kind of contradictions that are lived with. There's a great scene with a daughter who is playing with a white doll, and in the background is her mother putting on makeup and doing her eyelashes, getting ready for her husband to come home, who is this very discontent and disconnected person who is the character that carries all of that disappointment and uncertainty in the film. So there's a real nice contrast. The little girl is playing and singing and seems to a degree carefree in the way that kids do, and the images overall of the kids playing are wonderful, and they seem to be kind of liberated from all of the crushing lack of opportunity and uncertainties of their own future. And yet they're replicating in some ways these images that people were seeing about these quote-unquote riots and the looting and all of these things. The kids are playing games where they're throwing rocks and they're fighting and they seem to then get along, and they're playing in the environment which is the wreckage and the decay of their neighborhoods.
Yeah. It's a wonderful film. You can get it at you can rent it at Movie Madness. It's available through the Multnomah County Public Library. You can put a hold on it and wait your turn. Killer Sheep by Charles Burnett. This has been Fran Michelle and Denise Morris for The Old Mole.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. And I have a commentary about the larger context in which people who have been pushed to the margins try to push back, and how life might be different if the pushback could actually remove the burden of working for capital and turn work itself into something we would love doing. Nina Simone's song, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, asks exactly the right question.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear.
I argued last month on the Old Mole Variety Hour that a capitalist society is effectively governed by capital, driven by the implacable need for capital to grow. It must accumulate, bring more and more of the world into its clutches in the form of commodities, resources, human labor, and human desire for what it produces. Since that is its one and only interest, it has no concern for human or any other kind of life or for the conditions that sustain life. I said that those who work for capital, who manage pieces of capital in the endless game of investment, profit, and growth, have sold their souls to capital in a Faustian bargain for wealth and the power that wealth brings. Today, I'd like to expand on the fruits of this bargain and what it would mean to undo it. What happens to people who sell their souls to the devil, that is, to capital? They become instruments of capital, mere calculators of costs and benefits, sworn to manipulate people and resources in whatever ways will increase the return on investment. Regardless of any personal feelings they may have about damage done to people, animals, or the biosphere, as practicing capitalists, they must work to advance the interests of their share of capital and that includes insisting that what they are doing is within their rights and is even good for the world. How then have they lost their souls when they do this? To have a soul is to inhabit a living, loving, feeling, sensing, thinking, and caring body. It means being sensitive and responsive to the world, especially to each other. Most people start out as children with souls in this sense, and with the capacity to expand, fine-tune, and take increasing pleasure in what the earth provides and in their relationships with others. Art is one way we can enhance our awareness and love of the world. It is this open and ever-expanding sensitivity to and empathy with people's lives that is truncated by devoting oneself to capital. The masters and servants of capital often retain human feelings and sensitivity to friends and family and even to works of art. It is in their role as capitalists that they prune their souls down to pure economic calculation. It is not only the managers of capital, those who take on the goals of capital as their own, whose souls are truncated by capital. Capital strives to reduce all our desires to the desire for money, and money is provided to those who successfully compete with each other for the positions that capital makes available. That gives all of us reason to regard the interests of our fellow human beings as antagonistic to our own, limiting our empathy for them. Capitalists exacerbate this antagonism by emphasizing artificial differences like race and immigrant to prevent working people from uniting against them. At the same time, people like Amy Cantrell, interviewed at the top of today's show, work to help folks find common ground with others and thereby to retain their souls, their connectedness to others. Capital colonizes our souls by offering us substitute satisfactions, the pleasures of buying and having. Instead of enjoying our relations with the world and each other, we are led to imagine that the latest, biggest, and shiniest gadget will satisfy our desires and evoke the envy of our neighbors. So to the extent that our hopes and dreams revolve around exciting new possessions and the money to buy them, our souls have been taken over by capital. The desire to get and to have suffocates the pleasures of being and doing and loving. What this means is that the sensuous side of life, the erotic response to the world and to each other, is shackled by the requirements of life lived by the dictates of capital. The erotic is confined to the kind of sex modeled for us in the media. Pornography, advertising, movies, and TV. So the rest of life, including our work, is what we must do regardless of our desires. The erotic, pared down to mere sex, is restricted to what little time we have after work, paying bills, childcare, and keeping house. Audre Lorde writes, "The principal horror of any system which defines the good in terms of profit rather than in terms of human need, or which defines human need to the exclusion of the psychic and emotional components of that need, the principal horror of such a system is that it robs our work of its erotic value, its erotic power and life appeal and fulfillment. Such a system reduces work to a travesty of necessities, a duty by which we earn bread or oblivion for ourselves and those we love." End of quote. Suppose for a moment that the dominion of our lives by capital is what has made work a painful necessity and reduced what we can enjoy to commodified sex and the buying and owning of commodities. If so, then imagine the result of being free from the necessity of wage labor and the competition for money. What if we were united in a common social project of democratically managing the human and natural resources for the well-being and enjoyment of everyone? What Lorde called the erotic value and power of our work, indeed of all life, could be restored to us. Herbert Marcuse's 1955 book, Eros and Civilization, makes the case for this possibility, drawing on and critiquing Freud. Under non-repressive conditions, he writes, sexuality tends to grow into eros, that is to say, towards self-sublimation in lasting and expanding relations, including work relations, which serve to intensify and enlarge instinctual satisfaction. End of quote. In other words, waiting for us over the horizon, beyond capitalism, lies a world in which our deepest desires will be fulfilled as we work together to create the world which fulfills those desires. Erotic experience is when we know for sure that what we are doing right now is what we most want to be doing right now. That can happen in good sex. It can happen when we are making or listening to music we really love, or in a great conversation among people we feel at home with. Imagine that that was the way we felt most of the time. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew.
And that's Nina Simone wishing she knew how it would feel to be free. Something we cannot really experience in a capitalist society, but an experience we can aspire to. Of course, democratic practices and institutions are essential to freedom, and Thomas Hanna of the Democracy Collaborative is working to carry out a vision of a new economic system where shared ownership and control creates more equitable and inclusive outcomes, fosters ecological sustainability, and promotes flourishing democratic and community life. Here's the Old Mole's Lori Mercier to talk with him. Lori.
Thanks, Clayton. And as you heard, I'm speaking with Thomas Hanna, who is Research Director at the Democracy Collaborative in Washington, D.C. He has written widely about public ownership, privatization, democratic forms of ownership and control, and public banking in many forums, including In These Times, in The Nation. And he has a new book just out, Our Common Wealth: The Return of Public Ownership in the United States. Welcome to KABU, Thomas Hanna.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me on.
Your book, Our Commonwealth, demonstrates the critical need for alternatives to our economic system, and it also explores what these alternatives might look like with more public ownership. Let's talk about one sector of the economy, banking, since we're at the 10-year anniversary of the 2008 financial meltdown and the massive public bailout of banks, too big to fail. As you write, we're due for another financial crisis. So how can the left prepare for the next meltdown?
Yeah, exactly. So as you said, we're about 10 years on from the last financial crisis, and we know that in the neoliberal period that financial crises happen about every 10 years. And nothing has fundamentally changed in the structure of the financial system in the past 10 years. If anything, it's gotten worse. The banks are more consolidated. You know, they were too big to fail in 2007, 2008. They're even bigger today. The Dodd-Frank legislation that was put in place after the financial crisis last time was relatively weak legislation, and it's only been weakened over the past 10 years through concerted bank lobbying and efforts. So when the next financial crisis comes, we're going to be presented with a choice. It's going to be do the same thing as last time and just bail out the banks, or something different. And what I'm proposing is that something different is public ownership and potentially long-term public ownership.
So you say that we can start seriously preparing an alternative response right now. What would be some steps that we could take to help encourage public ownership? Because as you point out, the public bailout of banks was not popular, that a vast majority of Americans believe that this should not happen, that we should not be bailing out big banks. So it seems like the time is ripe for presenting some kind of alternative. And what would that look like?
Yeah, exactly. So when the last financial crisis happened, I think we can all pretty well say that we were not prepared for a financial crisis. And I think there was a pervading optimism in the country that we weren't going to have any more financial crisis, that these things had moderated. And that's always a pretty terrible view. You know, financial crises are as common as dirt in world history. So what we need to be doing now is, on the left especially, is really preparing for that and preparing for what the alternative might be to bailouts. Because absent an alternative, it's just going to be the same old thing. It's just going to be bailing out the banks. So what we can be doing is we can be mobilizing support for potentially introducing legislation or something that can be put in place now, and the groundwork and the legwork and all the research could be done now on that. And even if it never gets out of committee, you know, even if it's never voted on now, when the financial crisis happens, it can be dusted off the shelf and introduced as an amendment or something like that. You know, when the last financial crisis happened, I think around 33 senators voted to break up the big banks as part of an amendment to the Dodd-Frank legislation. I mean, that's unprecedented that they would vote to break up the big banks. So next time, we could potentially have that amendment or that legislation ready, and we could ask for public ownership. So essentially what we're saying is that when we give the banks money, because we're going to give them money again no matter what, when we give them money, instead of just giving it to them with no conditions attached, we would like to have voting rights. We would like to have equity stakes in those banks. We did quasi-nationalizations last time. We did some bailouts, but we also did some quasi-nationalizations. But it was totally messy. It was not transparent. There was a lot of behind-the-scenes dealing. All of the worst accusations about government involvement in markets were proven true, because the government was absolutely committed to not calling these nationalizations and doing everything possible to not take public ownership seriously in that case.
And despite the public bailout, the public got nothing in return, right? I mean, no ownership of that capital or control over its direction or any kind of vote on the direction, future direction of financial institutions.
Yeah, exactly. Public ownership, it gives us control. It gives us freedom of choice. We can, in the future, if we decide to take banks into public ownership, we can run them to support smaller community banks, kind of like the Bank of North Dakota does, which is one of our only public banks in the United States. It's 100 years old. Perhaps we could break them up. It's kind of a requisite to breaking them up. You have to take control of them first. When they're coming to us asking for money because they're about to collapse, then is not the time to break them up. You can't break up failing institutions. First, you're going to have to take them into public control, and then perhaps you could break them up into smaller public banks. Or we could run them for specific purposes, like financing the green transition. I mean, just today, the UN report on climate change was put out, and it suggests that we only have 12 years left to act decisively on climate change. So that suggests that we really need to focus all of our efforts, especially in the financial sector, on things like climate change and green energy transition.
Right. Now, given the massive power that the big banks have, what really is the likelihood of anything happening at the federal level in terms of changing legislation?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a plan for now, obviously. I mean, you wouldn't think that a plan for public ownership of banks would get through Republican control of Congress and then Republican control of the presidency. But as I said, I think this is more of a plan for the future. We need to have a plan ready so that when there is a financial crisis, there's an alternative put on the table, an alternative that's not been written by the banks just as a handout for them. So on the one hand, I think definitely pessimistic with regards to immediate prospects, but optimistic for the long term. I think you mentioned that the public hated the bank bailouts. I mean, there's been polling consistently since the financial crisis last time that they would much rather have considered public ownership than they would have considered to bail out the banks.
So it seems like increasing public ownership of banking is somewhat realistic or an attainable goal in the near future. Beyond banking, how can we reverse the trend of privatization and articulate an alternative vision of ownership for the common good? And you have ideas about this that you outline in your book, Our Common Wealth.
Yeah, exactly. And there's actually a good tie-in there to public banking, because on the one hand, we do want to prepare for the next financial crisis. On the other hand, there is a robust and vibrant movement going on in the United States at the local and at state level for public banking. So it's sort of two sides of the same coin. On the one hand, we need to organize at the federal level to try and do something different next time there's a crisis. But on the other hand, we do need to be setting up local public banks, state banks. There's an effort on the ballot, I think, in November in Los Angeles to have a city-run public bank. There's efforts in Oakland and Pennsylvania, different places. as well. And this really goes into, I think, a movement that's developing here in the United States and around the world in favor of public ownership and rejecting the failed approaches of privatization in the past. I mean, in Europe, you have a whole very, very robust remunicipalization movement in the energy sector, water, different types of services that have failed in privatization, and people are trying to bring them back in-house. And we have that here in the United States as well. As I said, public banking is one area, but municipal broadband is another area. Repealing the water privatizations that started to tick up in the 1990s and early 2000s, that's a big area. We're actually seeing a decrease of water privatizations and these things being taken back into public control. Baltimore, I think they have a ballot referendum on for November as well, which would become the first city in the United States to ban water privatizations as part of an amendment to their city charter.
Mm-hmm. So this kind of remunicipalization or municipal activism really provides a model around the country for taking more control over these critical institutions, developing more for the common good rather than private interests. So you also provide specific examples of more genuine democratic participation and control. So it's not just a matter of transitioning ownership from the hands of the few to some kind of public institution that also becomes somewhat stilted and doesn't offer much democratic participation in running those institutions. You have some ideas about how that could change as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think the thesis of the book, there are three main points I try to get across in the book. The first is that public ownership in the United States is much more prevalent and resilient than most people think. And it's expanding, as we just mentioned, in certain areas as people around the world reject these failed privatization approaches. The second is that contrary to what we've been led to believe during the neoliberal period over the past 40 years, there's actually no consensus in the academic literature, the theoretical and empirical studies about whether public or private ownership is actually more efficient. So I have plenty of studies. I have dozens and dozens of studies of different sectors all over the world and different time periods where you have these academics, people going in to study these things, and they say, well, to my surprise, the public-owned utility or the public enterprise is actually as efficient or more efficient than the private one. So, and then the third one is, as you mentioned, simply returning to the top-down managerial forms of public ownership that were dominant in the 20th century is not sufficient from the perspective of seeking a more equitable, democratic, sustainable economic system. What we need is internal democratization of these enterprises as well, and there are many different ways to think about internal democratization. So one of these is to have more accountability, to have more transparency. These are things that are kind of shared by more liberal or centrist beliefs around public ownership. But what we're saying here is we don't want to just have these arm's length corporations that are totally isolated from democratic control. What we want is more accountability, more transparency, and much more robust, genuine democratic participation internally. So this is more opportunity for workers, more opportunity for consumers, more opportunity for residents to participate in the decision-making of these enterprises, and then convert as well to participate in a much more macro sense in terms of the economy, how to direct these enterprises to participate together or to coordinate together to have much more control, democratic control over the whole economy and where we're going as a society.
And there's some specific examples of this kind of democratic control with electrical systems now in Richmond, California and Boulder, Colorado, right? Well, Thomas Hanna, thank you so much for joining us today. Thomas Hanna from the Democracy Collaborative, and we'll encourage listeners to take a look at his book, Our Commonwealth, The Return of Public Ownership in the United States. And also you can download his report, The Crisis Next Time, Planning for Public Ownership as an Alternative to Corporate Bank Bailouts, available on the Democracy Collaborative website. Thanks again, Thomas Hanna.
Thank you so much.
And that wraps up the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. Thanks to Amy Cantrell and Bill Resnick for their discussion of how people become more human by helping others. To our movie moles, Fran Michelle and Denise Morris for reviewing the film Killer of Sheep. To Laurie Mercier and Thomas Hanna for their discussion of democracy and public ownership. And to our engineer, Patricia Kullberg. I'm Clayton Margaridge. Tune in again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Mole's Underground Perspective when Denise Morris will be our host. Today's show will be available as a podcast in a day or two. You can get it where you get your podcasts as well as on the Old Mole Variety Hour page at kboo.fm. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter.